Hello and welcome to this digital class on soft matter. This class is actually not named soft matter. It doesn't even have a single unique name. It is actually offered to you under two names. It is offered to you within the content of the lecture on condensed matter in the chemistry curriculum, or it is offered to you within the lecture on advanced materials from soft to hard matter in the physics master program. What you're listening to is a subunit of both of these lectures offered to the respective student cohorts in an interactive and interdisciplinary fashion. The class is offered to both chemistry and physics students in an interactive inverted classroom or flipped classroom format, where you are supposed to consume digital lecture content before presence lesson units, in which chemists and physicists will meet in a room and interactively interact with the aim of in-depth understanding of the lesson content. The digital lecture material that you're supposed to prepare at home before the presence class is either reading material, scripts, PDF files for reading, or it is audio-visual streams for listening and watching, which you are doing right now if you're hearing this at the moment. You can pick whatever kind of material is more suitable for your learning personality, prepare it at home before the presence lesson unit. And very ideally, before that, you also participate in an online quiz offered to you via our university digital learning platform Moodle, in which you can answer a limited set of conceptual questions to the lecture material. And the answer statistics, not your individual answer, but the answer statistics of all the student cohort will reach the teaching personnel before the lesson unit, such that we as the teachers can optimally prepare the presence lesson unit based upon that content, which is not yet fully understood by the student group. The lecture encompasses the chemistry and physics of advanced condensed materials, and it has basically two parts. One part on hard condensed matter, which is offered by physics teachers, and one part on soft condensed matter, which is offered by a chemistry teacher, whom you're listening to right now. For this reason, I have just opened this lesson unit with the words, "Welcome to this digital class on soft condensed matter," which I will also do in the following further lesson units on this branch of the lecture. The soft matter part of this class consists of 6 lesson units, 2 of which giving you an introduction to what soft matter actually is, and 4 of which focusing on the most interesting and also most relevant type of properties of soft matter, which is already in its name, its softness, meaning its mechanical properties, which falls under the realm of rheology. In one or two of these lesson units, we will get to know what rheology in turn is, and then we will apply this to soft matter with a specific focus to the most versatile type of soft matter, which is polymers. But with that, we're actually already tackling the question, what soft matter actually is. Soft matter, or soft condensed matter, is a summarizing term for a whole class of materials, which are as different as polymers, colloids, amphiphiles, liquid crystals, and many more kinds of materials, which all, as diverse as they may appear at a first glance, share certain common aspects. One aspect is that they are neither true liquids nor true solids. They are something in between. They are viscoelastic materials. For this reason, they are also often called complex fluids. And the term soft matter has actually been introduced to overcome the term complex fluids. It was no one less than Pierre-Gilles Degenne, a French physicist and Nobel Prize laureate of the year 1991, who was awarded the Nobel Prize for his discovery of soft condensed matter, who opened his Nobel Prize speech with the words, "What do we mean by soft matter? Americans prefer to call it complex fluids, but this is a rather ugly name, which tends to discourage the young students." But what are the common grounds of all these diverse representatives of soft matter? It's actually 3 aspects that they all share. The first and maybe the most important one is the size of its building blocks. Soft matter is built up of building blocks a lot larger than normal materials. Normal materials are built out of atoms or molecules, and soft matter is built up of entities that are a lot bigger than atoms and molecules. Of course, they themselves also consist of atoms and molecules, but they form entities a lot larger than those, typically with sizes in the range of some tens to hundreds of nanometers or even micrometers. This is what we commonly term as the so-called colloidal domain. From the viewpoint of theoretically describing soft condensed matter, this implies to us already that we have to use coarse-grained models to do so. These models do not so much focus on the chemical specificity on nanoscopic scales, but more on the physical universality on colloidal scales. For example, if we consider polymers, you may know from your previous education already what polymers are. These are long chain-shaped molecules that consist of the multiple repetition of so-called repeating units or monomer units. And you may know or at least guess already that depending on the chemical identity of these repeating units, the polymers have different chemical properties. But from a viewpoint of physics, meaning from a viewpoint where we are on so large levels that we do no longer see the chemical identity of the polymer, they all share very general common aspects in their properties and behavior. The American scientist Paul Hemans, who wrote a seminal textbook named Polymer Chemistry, opened this textbook with the words, "It is not the amide in its IUPAC name that makes nylon an important material, but the poly." And this principle is actually broader. It holds for all kinds of soft matter. Due to the large or comparably large size of its building blocks, all different kinds of soft matter, as diverse as they may be chemically, show very general, generic, universal kinds of properties. The most relevant type of property is their soft mechanical appearance, their softness, which is actually the reason why we name soft matter soft matter. There is a second general aspect of soft matter that is also of direct relevance for the latter point. In addition to being composed of comparably large building blocks, these are held together by comparably weak interaction energies. If you're a chemist, you know what the energy of typical chemical bonds is. For example, a carbon-carbon bond in an organic molecule. This is typically in the range of some hundreds of kilojoules per mole. This is the most beloved energy scale that chemists use. Kilojoules per mole. And a carbon-carbon bond, for example, a carbon-carbon single bond, has an energy of 350 kilojoules per mole. For comparison, consider that the thermal energy at room temperature, R times T, has a value of only 2.4 kilojoules per mole. R, the gas constant, is about 8 joules per mole per Kelvin. Room temperature is about 300 Kelvin. So 8 times 300 is 2,400 joules per mole, or in other words, 2.4 kilojoules per mole. When comparing the bonding energy of a carbon-carbon bond, 350 kilojoules per mole, to that, we see that a carbon-carbon bond has a bonding strength of more than 100 times of thermal energy at room temperature. This is a really strong interaction energy, forming materials that are classically hard condensed matter. The hardest one you can think about is a material that's only built up of such bonds, diamond, which only consists of such carbon-carbon single bonds. Soft matter, by contrast, features interaction energies between its building blocks that are a lot weaker, that are only some singles to some tens of multiples of the thermal energy at room temperature. Together, the large size of its building blocks and the comparably weak interaction energies between them actually make the softness of soft matter. We can get a quantitative understanding of this already at this early point of our lecture when we consider the so-called cohesion energy density. This is nothing else than the energy of interaction between the building blocks over the volume in which it acts, which is basically the distance between building blocks cube. The distance between the building blocks is in the order of the size of the building blocks in turn. So a good estimate of the cohesive energy density is the energy of interaction over the size of the building blocks cube. If we calculate this for normal matter, matter built up of building blocks in the atomic or molecular size range, interacting with energies of order of magnitude of a couple of hundreds of multiples of the thermal energy at room temperature, we end up at cohesive energy densities of around 10 to the 12 Newton per square meter. By the way, the unit Newton per square meters originates because we have an energy over a volume. Energy has the unit Newton meters, volume has the unit meter cube, and if we divide Newton meter over meter cube, we get Newton per square meters. This is also the dimension of pascals, of a pressure. And as we see later on in our lecture, this is also the unit of a super important elementary material parameter, the elastic modulus. So this cohesive energy density gives us already a glimpse on what the elastic modulus of a material is. And this does actually make perfect sense. You may know the elastic modulus already from your introductory lectures. If you remember, the elastic modulus was a constant of proportionality occurring in Hooke's law, which is a law that tells us how big the force is we need to deform a material. It's actually not the force itself, it's force of area, which we name stress. And we may guess already that for a material that is built up of things that are held together by strong interactions, and that only over short distances, we need a lot larger force to deform this Then for materials, that is held together by weak interaction energies, which also act over large distances. And that makes us understand that this quantity that we have just estimated, the cohesive energy density, is a direct measure, is directly proportional to the elastic modulus. And for hard condensed matter, as it turns out, we obtain values of this quantity of around 10 to the 12 newton per square meters, and this is actually the range that many very hard materials, like diamond, show. If we do the same estimate for soft condensed matter, meaning if we calculate the comparably weak interaction energies of only some singles to tens of multiples of the thermal energy over the cube of distances in the range of some tens to hundreds of nanometers, we end up with values of only 10 to the 4 newton per square meters, so 8 orders of magnitude smaller or weaker than in the hard condensed matter case. And again, the 10 to the 4 newton per square meters are typical values of the elastic modulus that we measure for soft condensed matter. So this gives us already a quite fundamental and general understanding what soft matter is. It is materials built up of comparably large building blocks interacting by comparably weak interaction energies, and the combination of the two gives a rather weak cohesive energy density in the material, and that in turn manifests itself in a comparably soft mechanical appearance, low values of the elastic modulus. There is also a third aspect which is typical for soft condensed matter, and this is the timescales it takes for the material's building blocks to move. We can guess already that a very characteristic time for the dynamics of any material is the time that it takes for its building blocks to move distances equal to their own size. As soon as the building blocks of whatever material can move as far as they are big, they can displace against each other. And this is the microscopic, or we should better say nanoscopic, onset of flow of the material. Only if we give the material at least so much time that the building blocks themselves require to switch their positions, the material can macroscopically show the onset of flow. And this time, of course, in turn depends on how strong the interactions between the material's building blocks are and how large they are. And it's specifically the large size of the building blocks of soft matter that entails comparably long relaxation times. And this is a third hallmark of soft condensed matter. And if we take these hallmarks together, we realize that actually many kinds of materials fall into this classification scheme. For example, polymers, colloids, and amphiphiles. These are actually the three stereotype representatives of soft matter. They are so stereotype that they are often used to classify soft materials in a triangular scheme of visualization, which is named the Jülich soft matter triangle, as it was first introduced by researchers from Jülich in Germany. When we represent the landscape of soft matter as a triangle, we can imagine polymers, colloids, and amphiphiles to be denoted on the corners of this triangle. Any matter that is polymeric, colloidal, and or amphiphilic is soft matter, including the materials that fall into these corners, polymers, colloids, and amphiphiles, and also all different sorts of intermediate or hybrid forms, like block copolymers, which is sort of a hybrid of an amphiphile and a polymer, or microgels, which is sort of a hybrid of a polymer and a colloid, or so-called Janus particles, which is sort of a hybrid of an amphiphile and a colloid. Maybe the most fascinating representation of soft matter, that is everything that is polymeric and colloidal and amphiphilic in its nature, is to be plotted right into the center of this triangular diagram, and these are proteins. And this leads us already to maybe the most fascinating area where soft matter is important: life, living systems. Many structures in living systems, in organs, in cells, are built of soft materials, of polymers, of amphiphiles, of colloids, or of hybrid forms between them. And there is basically two fundamental reasons for nature to do so. They are both to be found in the three criteria that we have delimited to identify soft matter, namely weak interaction energies and comparably large sizes. And we can actually even understand this, at least on a very elementary level. Life is based on very complex structures that fulfill complicated functions that need to be assembled, disassembled, and reassembled constantly. For example, to correct defects. Nature is not successful by being defect-free, but by being defect-tolerant and by being able to repair defects. And this requires structures to be composed and decomposed upon demand. And this in turn demands the building blocks out of which these structures are composed to interact strong enough to hold them together, but also weak enough to allow them to be decomposed upon demand. And this is exactly realized by these kinds of interaction energies that are typical for soft condensed matter. And second, the buildup of complicated ordered structures that life is relying upon is actually nothing else than a huge amount of work against the second law of thermodynamics. A huge amount of work against entropy that always wants to be things in disorder. And it's somehow logical to use building blocks for that that do not cost so much entropy penalty because they are large. And if they are large, this means we don't have as many of them in a certain structure that we would have if they would be small. And if we build something out of not so many building blocks, we do not need to decrease entropy so heavily, because entropy in the end always depends on the number of building blocks or particles or molecules in a system. And this is actually broken down to a quite high level of simplification, I admit. One of the reasons why nature uses soft matter to build up structures whereupon life relies on. The second reason why soft matter is important is because it's soft, because it has soft mechanical appearance and is thereby qualified for all different sorts of useful applications, specifically in products that make our lives comfortable, such as soaps, gels, creams, and so on. The soft matter scientist Julian Oberdisse from Grenoble usually opens lectures like the one that you are just listening to with the words, "What is soft matter?" Well, that's easy to answer. Soft matter is actually everything you're not supposed to bring on an airplane. One last comment in this introductory section here. There is a third aspect that makes soft matter very attractive, besides being very beneficial for nature to create structures whereupon life relies on and being useful for many different sorts of applications. Soft matter is also a very suitable material to study elementary physics. It is built out of building blocks that are comparably large and comparably slow. But the general physics of assembly and disassembly, or of phase transitions, is actually the same as it is for normal matter, for matter built up of normal atoms and molecules. And this means soft matter gives us the ability to study these phenomena by, for example, microscopic methods. Soft matter is composed of building blocks that are so large and so slow that we actually have good chances in observing them. It is this feature that has brought Pierre-Gilles Dugène the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1991, who for the first time then framed the term soft matter. Okay, after this general introduction, let us have a look on the interaction energies, the intermolecular forces between building blocks of soft matter. This is certainly very relevant for us to know what kinds of interactions we actually know in chemistry and physics, and which are the most predominant ones for soft condensed matter. When we start this discussion from a very, very fundamental level, we can say that we know intuitively, more or less, that there have to be attractive forces between particles, between molecules and atoms. Why do we know that? Well, because if there wouldn't be attractive forces, any matter in the universe would be a gas. The existence of condensed matter, of liquids and solids, proves to us that there must be some kind of attractive interactions between molecules, which in some materials are predominant, making them liquids and solids, whereas in others they are not so predominant, making them gases. On the other hand, however, we also know that there must be some repulsive kind of interactions between atoms and molecules, because if there wouldn't be repulsive interactions, then every matter would be solids. So from these fundamental considerations, we can conclude already that we must have both attractive and repulsive interactions in nature, both being operative and the overlay of which, or the co-action of which, in the end, deciding what state of appearance, what kind of material, and what kind of temperature we'll have. In condensed matter, physics, and chemistry, we quantify these interactions by so-called interaction potentials. A very famous and important one is the so-called Lennard-Jones potential. It represents the distance-dependent sum of two such contributing potentials, of a repulsive and an attractive one. It's often called 6-12 potential, because the distance dependence of these two branches out of which it is composed are power laws with these very exponents. We have one power law for the repulsive interactions scaling with r to the minus 12, and one power law for the attractive interactions scaling with r to the minus 6. And the Lennard-Jones potential is then nothing else than the overlay, which mathematically means a sum of these two branches. Sum here is actually a difference, because the one enters with a negative sign. Figure 2.1 in our script shows you a graphical representation of this. You see a blue curve representing the repulsive potential, which has a very steep scaling with r to the minus 12, and positive values, because repulsion means rays of the energy if we bring the things together. And also you see a green curve representing the attractive interactions, which has a not so steep scaling, I mean also steep but not as steep, scaling with r to the minus 6, and this has negative values because attraction means gain in energy when we bring things together. And the most important curve in this diagram is the black curve. This is the overlay of the two. And we see that at short distances, the repulsive term, the blue one, dominates, raising the energy dramatically when we decrease the distance between our objects. Whereas at longer distances, the attractive potential dominates, leading to negative energies. The most negative one, the most favorable one, is at a certain equilibrium distance, which is named RGG in this figure. RGG stands for the German Gleichgewichtsabstand, R Gleichgewicht. At this point, our potential energy diagram has a well with a depth named epsilon. This potential energy function is very often encountered for unpolar materials, in which the attractive branch actually results from three different kinds of interactions. They are all dipolar interactions, but three different kinds of dipolar interactions, so-called Keesohm interactions, Debye interactions, and London dispersion interactions. Keesohm interactions are operative in materials where molecules or parts of the molecules exhibit permanent dipole moments. Figure 2.2 shows you two examples of such dipolar interactions for the example of carbonyl molecules. By contrast, the Debye interactions are operative between one permanent existing dipole and a second induced dipole, meaning between one molecule that carries a permanent dipole moment and another molecule which by itself is unpolar and has no dipole moment, but which is polarizable and in which a dipole moment is then induced by the presence and proximity of the other one that has a permanent one. And the third kind, the London dispersion interaction, is the interaction between two kinds of molecules that are both per se unpolar, but in which random fluctuations of the electron density create a momentary, a temporary dipole moment, which then induces a counterpart in the neighboring molecule. This dipole-dipole coupling is present in one moment and gone in the next moment, but in this next moment is then again present somewhere else in the system. And these constantly occurring fluctuations of the dipole moment cause an always present dipolar interaction. All these kinds of interactions are dipolar interactions, and as such they all scale with r to the minus 6. As a counterpart to these three different kinds of attractive interactions, we then also add a repulsive potential branch in the Lennard-Jones potential, which scales with r to the minus 12. This is actually an arbitrary scaling. We could have used something else here. We could have also used r to the minus 13 or r to the minus 11. We have more or less randomly chosen r to the minus 12 because this is a very steep scaling, and that is what we need for repulsive interactions. And the number of 12 is somehow, let's say, symmetric to the number of 6 that has an actual physical reason for the attractive interactions. The reason for the repulsive interactions is actually quantum mechanics. It's actually the Pauli principle. When we bring together two molecules to very close proximity, at some point the electron shells start to overlap. And this means electrons then are forced to share regions in space where electrons with same quantum numbers, which belong to different atoms, but have the same quantum numbers, are forced to share the same space. And this is forbidden by the Pauli principle, forcing the electrons to escape to higher energy levels, to be promoted to higher orbitals, and this costs a lot of energy. And so we have a very steep raise of the energy here, as said, typically represented by a more or less arbitrarily chosen scaling of r to the minus 12. At very long distances in figure 2.1, we see a level off of the potential. This is the point where both the repulsive and the attractive term have only small, meaning close to zero values, and so does its overlay have. Here, the molecules or particles or building blocks that we consider are so far away from each other that they don't recognize each other, so to speak. They don't see each other anymore, and so it also doesn't matter when we bring them a little further apart or a little closer together. In addition to these three kinds of dipole interactions that we have just named, Keesohm, Debye, and London dispersion interactions, we also have other kinds of interactions in condensed matter. The strongest one is ion-ion interactions. If we have an ionic species, which is built out of oppositely charged building blocks, those have very strong Coulomb-type interaction energies, as expressed by equation 2.1 in our script. This is the Coulomb equation, in which epsilon m is the so-called electric permittivity of the medium that we consider, which in turn is composed of the electric permittivity in vacuum, epsilon zero, and the relative permittivity of the medium that we consider, epsilon relative, which in vacuum is one. The typical order of magnitude of such ionic interactions is very strong, 10 to the minus 18 joules, which is as strong as our initial calculation that we have done at the beginning of this lesson unit. Very strong interaction of several hundreds up to thousands of multiples of the thermal energy at room temperature. This interaction, however, is made a lot weaker if we add a medium to our substance. For example, water. This adds a relative permittivity of 80. The dielectric constant of water is 80. And this means it attenuates the interaction energies quite a lot to values of around 10 to the minus 20 joules. And this is then more in the vicinity of the thermal energy at room temperature. It's not exactly the thermal energy at room temperature, but it's only several multiples of it. And this allows these ionic interactions to be broken. This is the reason why salt dissolves in water. The actual reason for this to happen is the increase of entropy that happens upon that, but it's made possible by the weakening of these interaction energies, which normally prohibit it. Another kind of interaction of similar strength is covalent chemical bonds, as the chemists among you know already. For example, as mentioned in the beginning of this lesson unit, carbon-carbon single bonds, 350 kilojoules per mole. If we express that per molecule in the units of joules, this is again 10 to the minus 18 joules. Again, several hundreds of multiples of the thermal energy at room temperature. A specific kind of such chemical bonds are metallic bonds, which basically composed of delocalized electrons on top of a lattice of atomic cores of metal atoms. All these interactions are typical interactions being present in hard condensed matter, like the metals mentioned in the latter example. For soft condensed matter, other kinds of interactions are predominant. Most predominantly, the dipole-dipole interactions of the three kinds we have just mentioned. These are commonly summarized under the term van der Waals interactions. There is one specific kind of these interactions that I'd like to point out specifically here, as it's very relevant, specifically in biology or biochemistry, hydrogen bonding. Hydrogen bonding is actually a specific variant of a dipolar interaction. It occurs if a hydrogen atom is covalently bound to an electronegative atom, most typically oxygen or nitrogen, such as shown in figure 2.3a. Because of the small size of this hydrogen atom and its single electron, the side of the atom, which is at the opposite of the electronegative atom that it's bound to, presents an unshielded positive charge, which can then interact with a free electron pair of an electronegative atom. This results in a quite directed attractive interaction, which is actually stronger in magnitude than the normal dipolar interactions that we summarize in the van der Waals interactions, but more of the order of magnitude of a fraction of a chemical bond. Figures 2.3b and c show you typical chemical motifs that act as donors or acceptors of such hydrogen bonding interactions. Okay, after this general introduction, let us close our discussion for today by looking upon four very predominant kinds of soft condensed matter: polymers, colloids, and amphiphiles, and on top of that, so-called liquid crystals, which are not a material, but more a state of appearance of materials, for which most classical experiments, such as many of those of Pierre-Gilles Dugène, have been made in the process of discovery of the arcing principles of soft matter science. Let us start with the maybe most relevant class of soft matter, polymers. At least it's certainly the most versatile kind of soft matter. The term polymer derives from the Greek poly and meros, meaning many in parts. This means polymers are molecules composed of many parts, specifically of many repeating units, often also named monomer units. The IUPAC, the International Union of Pure and Applied Chemistry, defines a polymeric molecule as follows. A molecule of high relative molecular mass, the structure of which essentially comprises the multiple repetition of units derived, actually or conceptually, from molecules of relative low molecular mass. In many cases, the addition or removal of one or a few of the units has a negligible effect on the molecular properties. From this definition, we recognize that whereas the term macromolecule, that you also may have heard throughout your so far education, generally refers to any sort of large molecule, whereas the term polymer specifies this to those kinds of large molecules built up of a structure that is composed of a multiple repetition of sequential units, repeating units, or as often said, monomer units. Hence, each polymer is a macromolecule, but not necessarily each macromolecule is also a polymer. Table 2.1 in our script shows to you some typical examples of polymers and depicts the structure of both the monomers out of which it is built and the resulting polymeric sequence after the reaction of those monomers. There is basically two kinds of reaction types or schemes by which polymers can be built, so-called chain growth processes and step growth processes. In very general, polymers are synthesized by the sequential reaction of monomers, such as the one shown in Table 2.1, as shown for these two classes of reactions in Figure 2.4. Monomers are molecules that carry chemical groups that can form connections to each other. Most typically, this is either the opening of a double bond, which can get initiated by a suitable initiating species, and in turn become very reactive radicals that may then attack other such double bonds in a chain reaction type of further reaction, as shown in the left-hand side schematic of Figure 2.4. Or it can be pairs of mutually connectable functionalities, such as nucleophilic groups on one molecule and electrophilic groups on another molecule. And if we have two of these in each molecule, or one of each per molecule, then these can react to form chains, step by step, in a step growth fashion, as shown in the right-hand side schematic of Figure 2.4. We can also further chemically modify the resulting polymers, either already at the level of the monomers, whereby a certain portion of the monomers is replaced by a derivative carrying certain functions, which are then incorporated into the polymer, or we can do this later on the polymer level. Typical functionalization encompasses the equipment of the polymer with chemical groups that can act as connection sites later on to connect further side groups to a polymer, such as dye molecules, labels, for example, fluorescent labels, or binding sites that can bind our polymer to surfaces or to biological entities. Such modification may also encompass the cross-connection of different polymer units, either during the polymerization or after polymerization, in both cases forming a polymeric network. As a result, we can imagine various different kinds of polymer topologies, three of which shown to you in Figure 2.5. We can imagine a linear polymer chain, which often is shaped up in a coiled conformation. We can think about branched polymer molecules, and we can think about cross-linked polymer molecules. And then the term molecule is actually becoming somehow difficult. Here we should better speak about polymeric substances in general. The result in either case is a large entity, a large macromolecule. And as we have said in the beginning of this class, this is one of the three hallmarks of soft matter in very general. But what is the typical length scale of polymers? We can actually very simply estimate this. The most common chemical bond of a typical monomer is a carbon-carbon double bond, which has a length of 134 picometers. During polymerization, this is converted into a sequence of carbon-carbon single bonds that have a length of 154 picometers. And with this, we can calculate the length of an entire polymer chain by simple summation. The length that we obtain from this is named contour length, because this is the length that we measure from one end to the polymer to the other by walking along the contour of the polymer chain. This would also be the length that we would measure if we would take the two ends and stretch them apart from each other to elongate the chain to a linear shape. For example, if a polymer consists of, let's say, 2000 monomeric units, the corresponding chain would be 308 nanometers long. We can further refine this calculation by taking into account that the monomer units have a certain bonding angle between them. Most typically, this is the tetrahedron angle of 109 degrees if it's a carbon-carbon bond. And if we wish to take into account this geometry also in our calculation, we have to add a little geometry factor, which is basically nothing else than the sine of this angle. And the calculation is then simply the number of segments times the length of a segment times this geometrical factor, giving us a little smaller size. Both is visualized to you in Figure 2.6a of our script. But both these estimates are actually not very helpful because they give us the contour length of the polymer, the length of the chain measured along its path, along its contour. What we're actually interested in is the size of the object that the polymer forms, which most typically has a random coil conformation, and we are interested in the size of this coil. And there is actually two useful and often used measures for the size of such an object. One is the so-called end-to-end distance. This is actually very simple to calculate, as it's shown to us in equation 2.3 of our script. The end-to-end distance vector is nothing else than the sum of all bonding vectors in our chain. as visualized in figure 2.6b. Another common average quantity to describe the size of a polymer is the so-called radius of gyration, which is basically calculated by a mass-weighted sum of the square of distances of mass elements out of which our object, in this case polymer coil, is composed. This is given to you in equation 2.4 of our script and shown to you in figure 2.6c. What we do here is we sit ourselves into the center of mass of our object and then take the square of the length of each vector from the center of mass to each mass unit. In our case, these are the monomer units, weighted by the mass of the mass units. In our case, this is the always equal mass of the monomer units. And the outcome of this, according to equation 2.4, is the so-called radius of gyration. This radius of gyration gives us the radius that a spherical object would have that has the same density as our object of interest, in our case as our polymer coil, and the same moment of inertia. For this reason, the radius of gyration in German language is also often referred to as Trägheitsradius. We can guess already that both the end-to-end distance and the radius of gyration will depend on, well, of course, how many monomer units are in a given polymer object and how long the bonding vectors are, of course. But this will also depend on how the local arrangement of the units is, whether the angle between the bonds is large or small. The chemists among the audience may know that the angle between the bond is given. It's the bonding angle. It's given by the chemistry. Most predominantly, it's the tetrahedron angle in carbon-carbon bonds, which is 109 degrees. But there is also a second angle in this play, which is the bond torsion angle. We basically have to invest only very small energies to rotate chemical bonds, single bonds, against each other. And this can bring the substituents at each atom at the end of a bond either to close proximity in space or to wider distance in space. We name the close conformation the cis conformation and the wide conformation the trans or gauche conformation. And we may guess already that some chemical substituents, for example such that are rather bulky in space, are harder to rotate against each other than such that are less bulky in space. And so we can guess already that the chemical substitution pattern, the kinds of chemical substituents at the level of single bonds in the polymer, determines whether each single local bond arrangement is on average rather short or rather wide. And this in turn will of course also determine the shape and thereby the size of the polymeric object. A quantity that captures both the chemical bonding angle and the most favorable bond torsion angle at the level of single bonds in a polymer is the so-called characteristic ratio, as given to you in equation 2.5 of our script. And together with that quantity, equation 2.6 gives us an expression for the mean square end-to-end distance of a polymer, which is nothing else than this characteristic average, which we often abbreviate by the term C infinity, times n, which is the number of segments, times the square of the length of each segment or each bond in the polymer. With this equation, we can calculate what the size of the polymeric objects, which typically have the shape of a random coil, actually is. And if we do such calculation for a typical number of bonds, for example, let's say again 2000 bonds, and a typical bonding length, for example, 154 picometers, and for typical values of the characteristic ratio, which typically has values between 2 and 20 more or less, we get a number for the size of the resulting polymer coil object, which typically turns out to be some singles to tens up to hundreds of nanometers, right in the colloidal domain, right in the domain of the building block size of soft matter. Other typical kinds of soft matter building blocks are colloids and surfactants. There's actually a lot less to say about those. Colloids are actually nothing else than small solid particles. Typically, they themselves consist of polymers in a so-called glassy state, forming spherical solid particles with sizes of something between a nanometer and a micrometer, sometimes a couple of micrometers. Colloids can also be liquid particles, or let's better say liquid droplets. One example from everyday life is milk, which is a colloidal dispersion of fat and proteins forming droplets of a size of typically 0.1 micrometer in water. The size of these droplets in the colloidal domain is also in the range of the wavelength of visible light, causing this light to be scattered heavily, which makes the white color appearance of milk. The third elementary kind of building block of soft matter are surfactants. These are molecules that consist of both hydrophilic and hydrophobic parts. They typically have a hydrophilic head group and a hydrophobic tail. And as a consequence, they can dissolve both in water and in oil by assembling themselves into micelles, such that the group, which is friendly to the respective medium, points to the outside to have contact with the medium, whereas the other group points to the inside, as shown to you in figure 2.7 of our script. And these micelles, these assemblies of the surfactant molecules, those are entities, again, with sizes of typically some tens to hundreds of nanometers, again making building blocks for larger assemblies in soft matter systems made out of amphiphilic assemblies. There is a whole lot of very fascinating structures of amphiphilic assemblies, depending on the kind of amphiphile, its chemical composition, and its concentration in the system. All of which, however, featuring typical sizes or distances in the colloidal domain, interacting by comparably weak interaction energies of the dipolar kind, thereby forming soft mechanical appearance. There is one more state of matter to be mentioned here, and this is liquid crystals. Liquid crystals are actually not a unique kind of material. They are a material state. Liquid crystals are so-called mesophases, meaning arrangements of building blocks, either small molecules or larger entities such as particles or polymers, that have anisotropic shapes, thereby being able to arrange themselves such that they have order in certain directions in space, but disorder in others, resulting in semi-ordered states, which have characteristics of both liquids and solids. On the one hand, they exhibit a certain kind of regular ordering, like in crystals, but from other viewpoint angles, they do not, like in liquids. We can generally derive liquid crystal phases in two broad classes, spectic and nematic, as shown to you in figure 2.8 of our script. In the sequence of panels from A to C, we see an increasing amount of disorder in the material. Panel A shows an actual crystalline material, panel B shows a smectic liquid crystal, C shows a nematic liquid crystal, and D shows a disordered isotropic fluid. The reason why we are mentioning liquid crystals here is that many of the discoveries of soft matter science, for example, the concepts of viscoelasticity, have been predominantly developed on liquid crystalline materials. It was also liquid crystals that made Pierre-Gilles Dejeune recognize fascinating universality, for example, in ordering and disordering phase transition phenomena. And for that reason, liquid crystals, while they are not a kind of material, they are an important kind of appearance of materials that has made very important contributions to the development of soft matter science. With that, we're at the end of this lesson unit. It has given us an introduction to the fascinating world of soft matter. We have learned what soft matter actually is, what its general arcing principles are, what kind of materials fall into this category, and what characterizes them. In the next lesson unit, we will dive deeper into this. We will learn more about polymers, colloids, and amphiphiles, making us recognizing even more how rich soft matter is in structures, appearances, and in the ability to derive structure properties from that. To become able for that, we also need suitable experimental techniques to characterize the structural arrangement of soft matter, and we will get a general introduction to these kinds of techniques that you will also consider in much more detail in a further chapter of our class, which is scattering techniques. Together, I hope that we will become able to bring together the seemingly rather scattered aspects of soft matter to a unique and rationally understandable principal concept.